You're listening to the teaching ministry of Houston's First Baptist Church, a relevant biblical community. For more information, visit houstonsfirst.org. Here's Pastor Greg Mott.
Well, I want you to turn in your Bibles to John chapter 13. I've been waiting to tell you that for a long time now. It's been great to be away on sabbatical for a month, and I know what some of y'all think. Sabbatical is a preacher's way of saying I went on vacation. It's just a spiritualization of vacation. Well, that is true that there is vacation aspects to it, and it is true that there's times of rest, and it is true that there's times of great focus. And what a sabbatical is, more so than a time of vacation, it's a time of focus. It's a time when I can kind of let go of everything else that's going on, all the other responsibilities, and say, okay, I'm going to focus in, and I'm going to look very clearly, very focused at the things that we're doing, at the places we're going, at the messages I'm going to be preaching, all of those things to be able to focus in. So instead of 10 things, it's one thing to be able to do that. Now, when I would do that, typically what would happen is each morning, kind of weekday mornings, I wasn't hard and fast on this, but from about 9 to 2, I would spend time preparing, spend time studying, spend time writing. I'm writing another book, and it's going to come out in April, and it's called I Am Changes Who I Am. So the I Am of God changes who I am as a person, and it's based on John, what we've been talking about, the 7 I Am statements in John, the 7 miracles in John. And so I was able to write a lot on sabbatical, which was great, able to prepare messages, get things ready of where we're going. So it was really, really great, and some great family time. We got together with just, you know, our family and other folks, and it was wonderful. I didn't realize how much my family needed time away, how much my family needed that break where we could just get together, and that was wonderful to see. I accomplished more on this sabbatical than I ever have on any other. It's been amazing to see all that I've gotten to be able to accomplish in writing and preparing and resting and time with family. And basically two reasons why I think that happened. One, I was able to focus and just say, okay, I'm going to knock it out from 9 to 2. And then secondly, I did not read a lot. Does that sound weird? I did not read a lot. Previous sabbaticals, I would go on to sabbatical with 10 books, and I felt like a college student with a summer reading list. And somehow I had to prove that my sabbatical was intelligent and it was the right thing, and because I was going to read all these books. And I just decided on this sabbatical, I'm going to read when I want to read, and I'm going to read what I want to read. So I read a couple books and had a great time with it, and I ended up getting more done and more refreshment than anything. It was a great, great time of focus, not just rest. But I tell you what, to be back with you is just a wonderful thing. To be back here where God's called us to be is a great deal. And we're going to look in the verses of John chapter 13, verses 1 through 5. And as we look at this, we're kicking off John. If you remember last year, kicking off the second half of John, last year we looked at John chapters 1 through 12. John chapter 1 through 11 is the 3 years of Jesus' ministry. John chapter 12 through 21 is the last week of Jesus' life. So where we are, just to give you a little thing, you'll know where we are. This is the last week of Jesus' life, and John chapter 13 is the beginning of the upper room, where he takes the disciples to the upper room. They have the Lord's Supper in the upper room. That's interesting. In the book of John, there's no discussion of the Lord's Supper. That's found in other Gospels. But here we have in John 13 and 14, the Last Supper, and we're able to say, okay, God, we want to see what you're doing. What's the last things he'd want to teach us his last week on planet Earth? What would be the last things Jesus wanted to say? And we're going to see in this book of John that he has got some things for us, but it begins with something. It begins with service. The first thing that Jesus is going to say, when he's got everybody in the upper room, all his disciples, he's going to begin with service. Now, some of you might be tennis fans, and you know who Andy Roddick is. Andy Roddick is an amazing tennis player. We got a picture of him, I think, up there. He's got the world record for the fastest serve from 2004 to 2011. 155 miles an hour. Imagine that, 155 miles an hour. Now, when you think about tennis, one of the most important things is the serve. That's the beginning of a tennis match, is the serve. That's the thing that gives you the most power. Whoever's got the serve has got the advantage. You begin with the serve, and his serve was amazingly powerful. And Jesus Christ, as well, begins with the serve. When he begins teaching his disciples, when he gets them into the upper room, he begins with the serve. He says, look, I'm going to hit 155 miles an hour, because if I can jack that all the way through, that's going to give us an incredible advantage. And so we begin our teaching time this year with the serve, to be able to say that we're going to serve. Y'all jumped, didn't you? That was great. That was great. When I was practicing that earlier in the week, what I did is I got on this aisle and I started hitting it down the aisle, and I was nailing it down the aisle, but the only place is I was hitting people's armrests too. So I thought, I'd just get you like that, and I got every single one of you. That's awesome. Now, just to put the ball out in the crowd, whoever catches this gets $5 off at Corner Books. Let's see if I can get it to the balcony. Let's see. Oh, yeah, there we go. Perfect. There, she got it. Perfect. Way to go. It begins with the serve. It's funny when you hit a ball out at a baseball game, people go crazy at church. Everybody goes, oh, that's very nice. Yeah, very calm, very calm. That's nice. But the whole thing begins with the serve. That's the power. That's what gets it going. So let's look now at what Jesus tells his disciples about service. He's going to tell them something about service. And when he tells them this, it's going to say, okay, we're setting this thing off. Look in John chapter 13, verse 1 through 5. Here it is. It was just before the Passover feast. Jesus knew that the time had come. Underline, Jesus knew. Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave the world and to go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, now he showed them the full extent of his love. It literally means in the Greek to love them to the final goal. So he's taking them to the cross of his service. In the evening meal, verse 2, was being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. You know who Judas is? That's why you never went to school with anybody named Judas. He's a bad guy. Here we go. Prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. Verse 3, key verse. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power. He has no mistakes. He is in control of everything. And that he had come from God. He knows he's come from heaven. And was returning to God, the cross and resurrection. Verse 4. So he got up from the meal, and he took off his outer clothing and wrapped a towel around his waist, and after that he poured water into the basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. Now here is Jesus washing the disciples' feet. Now that's a weird concept for us as human beings in this day and age. When we think of washing people's feet, we're like, what in the world? I understand shining shoes. I understand, you know, being nice to people and hospitable. But washing people's feet, that sounds weird. So we could take this story and we could throw it out and say, well, there's nothing for me in this story, because we don't do that in our culture. Here's what they did in that Middle Eastern culture. Obviously, it's a very dusty, dry place. And people would be walking in sandals, so their feet would be caked with dust and dirt by the time they would get to a house. So the host of the house would have a servant come along, and he would wash their feet. It would be preparing them to come into the house, preparing them to come to dinner. The lowest servant, not the chief servant, the lowest servant would be there at the door, not to just take their coat, but to wash their feet. And Jesus Christ is going to wash the feet of his disciples. He's going to take on the very nature of a servant. He's going to begin with serves. He's going to begin with serving, with service. And when we see this, we have to go, wait a minute, wow, Jesus Christ is serving in this way. This is an amazing thought. So here come the disciples into the place for the upper room, and they're eating at dinner, and Jesus is going to take on the nature of a servant, and he is going to wash their feet. Now let's talk about service for just a second. See, service has to begin somewhere. Humility is the father of service. Humility is the father of service. If you want to have a servant's heart, if you want to be a man or woman that serves, if you want to put other people in front of yourself, you're going to have to be, I'm going to have to be humble. Humility is the father of service. Philippians chapter 2, verse 5 and following, it says, your attitude, that's me and you, should be the same as that of Christ Jesus, who, being in the very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but he considered himself nothing, taking on the very nature of a servant. And then it says, following, that he was obedient to death on a cross. Humility is the father of service. That's where it begins. It begins with a heart of humility, and a heart of humility is a place of service. Now it says that he loved them to the end. To the end, he loved them. He showed them the greatest love. Do you know how you could show people greatest love? It's by being humble before them. You show people greatest love by being servants. You show people greatest love by saying, you go first instead of me. Humility is the father of service. But let me ask this question. How do we define humility? We have incorrectly defined humility. This is what we've done. We have tried to say we are good at this. We've got that. We've got the time, talent, and resources. We're good at something. And humility is to act like you're not good at the thing you know you're good at. That's what you do. So if we act like we're not good at the thing that we know that we're good at, then we're really being humble. So here's what we do. A pretty lady says, oh, no, I'm not pretty. Oh, these clothes, this whole thing. When she knows in her heart, she's beautiful and this is a brand new dress, right? Somebody says, well, we've got a house. It just keeps the roof, keeps the rain off our head. We just got a little house down the street. No, you have a mansion is what you have, okay? And it keeps you rain off your head in thousands upon square feet, right? Somebody comes along and says, well, man, you're really good at that. Oh, no, I'm not. I'm not really good at that. You know, our business, we've just been lucky in this economy. No, for decades, you've shown up early and stayed late, and you've been a wonderful businessman. That's what's happened. But we think that humility is taking a compliment about something we're gifted at possibly, we're good at possibly, we possess possibly, and then acting like we're not gifted, good at, or don't possess it. Because we feel a little bit guilty that we got it. So rich people are trying to always convince people they got stuff on sale. Right? People that are pretty are always trying to say, no. People that have great successes are trying to act like it's a fluke. And we think that that's humility, but what happens is it's not humility. It's a lie. So we can't figure out how God calls us to humility, but it's actually calling us to lie. What is humility? It's not faking that you're not good at something. Some of you have been incredibly gifted, incredibly blessed. All of us have got some type of gift and talent that God's given us. It's taking that and it's giving it to God. Let me explain humility in this way. Humility is self-forgetfulness. Humility is self-forgetfulness. It's in what I do well, I am not the direct recipient of it. It's not about me. So what happens is we throw out our beauty, but we know that it's going to boomerang right back on us because our beauty is for us. It makes us feel better. We throw out our resources and they boomerang out, and yes, they boomerang and go to other places, but they ultimately come back on us. Because it's about self. We boomerang our talent and our time and all the things, and we boomerang it back, and it comes around. And then we look and we say, oh, I'm so humble. And as soon as you say you're humble, you lost it, right? So what we have is this confusion that we think that it's just dumbing down what we know we're good at when it is truly forgetting ourselves in the midst of it. Here's what C.S. Lewis says. Thousands of humans have been brought to think that humility means a pretty woman trying to believe that she's ugly, or a clever man believing that he's a fool. God wants to bring man, though, to a state of mind in which he could design the best cathedral in the world and know it was the best. He could rejoice in the fact that it's the best, but he would have been glad if anybody else would have done it besides him. God would rather that man would think himself to be a great architect, a great poet, than he would to spend time and pains trying to think he was a bad one. So it's not trying to think that it's good. You know you're good at something, and you try to convince yourself you're bad. I'll just use a personal illustration. When I first started teaching and sharing the Bible, people would come out and say, that was really good. And so what I would do is I'd say, oh, no. It just blah, 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 blah. And then finally I had to kind of wake up and go, look, if I'm not good at speaking, I need to not be a pastor, right? That'd be a problem for you particularly, okay, and me a whole lot too. So instead, let me say, Lord, you've gifted me with teaching. You've gifted me with leadership. Thank you for that. Let me forget myself in it. Now let me do it for other people and for you. I'm out of it, so now God can shine through it. Do you see the difference? Self-forgetfulness is utilizing what you're good at, your time, your talents, your resources. What is it that you have? Forgetting yourself in it, and then it's thrown out to God, and it's thrown out to other people. And then you have true service. But when it's just a boomerang back to us, we're still the center of it. And we try to play games with ourselves. Well, I know that was for me, but let me act like it's not. And back and forth it goes. Now watch this happen in verse 3 if you look in your Bible. Verse 3, here's what it says. Think about this. Understanding who you are. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power. That's big time. God has everything under your power. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power and that he, Jesus, had come from God. He knew he was the Son of God and he was returning to God. Verse 4, underline this. So he got up from the meal and took off his outer clothing and wrapped the towel around his waist. Verse 3 says that he knows he's got everything under his power. He knows that he's from God. He knows that he's going back to God. So here's what happens. Jesus doesn't show up and the disciples go, Jesus, you're the Son of God. Well, no, not really. I mean, I'm just kind of the Son of God. And, you know, Jesus, you turned water into wine. Well, I mean, yeah, I guess I did. But how'd you feed the 5,000? Well, you know, it's crazy. I know this place and I get bread real cheap. And I had a family member that was, he owned a restaurant. And so I learned some things in the kitchen. I don't know. You raised Lazarus from the dead. Yeah, I wasn't that lucky. I said, Lazarus, arise. And this dead man came out at the same time. I know, it's just crazy. Jesus is like, I know exactly who I am. I am the Son of God sent from heaven to save the world. There's no question about it. There's no discussion about it. I've declared it in 7 I am statements. I've declared it in 7 miracles. I know that I am from the Father. I'm going to the Father. And I have all things under my power. That's verse 3. Verse 4. So, therefore, now he got up. He got up. And he took a towel and put it around his waist and he washed the feet. Do you see the connection? He knew he was the Son of God. He knew he was great at raising the dead, great at feeding 5,000, wonderful at healing the blind. He could heal a lame man easily, no problem for Jesus. He knew that, so he got up. The fact that Jesus understood who he was and then served, that shows humility and greatness. Knowing what you're good at and knowing what God has gifted you with, and then you serve is different than trying to act like you're not good at something. If anybody on planet Earth should never get up, it's Jesus. If anybody ought to be brought the dessert menu at dinner, it's Jesus. If it's anybody that deserves a valet parking spot, it's Jesus. If there's anybody in all of creation, it is Jesus Christ, the creator of the world, sitting at that meal. Nobody should ever expect Jesus to get up and get his own glass of tea. And yet, he knew who he was, and he got up. He got up. And he became the lowest slave by choice. He kneeled down, and he began to wash the feet of the disciples. Now, if that wasn't big time enough, hear it. You ready? He washed Judas's feet that night. He washed the feet of Judas. The Son of God, creator of the earth, sent from heaven, perfect, without sin, miracles on his resume, gets up, bows down, and washes his enemy's feet. See, when you understand who you are, you have great love, great security in loving your enemies. When you're insecure about who you are, you can't love your enemies because that might give them a one-up. But when you know who you are, then you can love your enemies. You could serve anybody. You could serve in any way you want to. You can lay aside, it says he lays aside his outer garment and he takes on the waist, the cloth around his waist of a slave. See, he has complete security in who he is, and humility is the father of service. He has forgotten himself, and now he is realizing, he knows that he is interiorly, he is the Son of God. So exteriorly, it doesn't matter if he lays aside his garments or not. See, you and I are so focused on our exterior, aren't we? We're so focused on our exterior, we've forgotten our interior. Do you know that you are an interior person? You have a soul? You really, C.S. Lewis says, you are a soul, you have a body. We a lot of times think we're the body and we have a soul. It's actually the reverse. You are an eternal creature having an earthly existence. That's what you are. You're an eternal creature having an earthly existence. So instead of decorating the outside like we like to do, we lay aside the outside and we serve. And we get up from our positions and we serve. Tony Evans, African-American preacher up in Dallas, I wish I could say it like him, but just hear his voice in your mind. Here's what he says. Man was made from the ground. He's an earthling. On his best day, he's just dignified dirt. In fact, every living person is only worth $3.57. When a person dies, all of their components return to dirt, and the value is about $3.57. That's why you can't think too highly of yourself. You're just not worth that much. So when you get into your bins, it's only $3.57 driving your bins. When you drive into the suburbs, it's only $3.57 living in the suburbs. It's $3.57 wearing designer clothes. It's $3.57 with more money in the bank than you're actually worth on your physical body. Now, we know we're worth great things, but what's the worth that's the greatness of us is the soul, isn't it? It's not the exterior. You could lose a limb and you're not any less valuable. It's the interior, and so Jesus knows of his interior, so he gets up and he washes the feet of the folks that are there. Did you notice the phrase, got up? I love it. Here's the deal. Humility is an action, not just an attitude. Humility is an action, not just an attitude. We could talk about the homeless all day long. We could talk about people with cancer all day long. We could talk about reaching out to people all day long. We could talk about putting others first all day long. We're great at that as a church, aren't we? The action is what God is saying. It's not just Jesus sitting back saying, wouldn't it be great if somebody washed our feet right now? Wouldn't it reminding them back to when they walked in that room, a servant possibly washed their feet already? Instead, he gets up and he says, I want to turn this attitude into an action. He didn't announce it. He didn't stand up and say, I'm about to serve now. Just want everybody to know, this is the point in the meal that I'm going to stand up and serve. Everybody watching me, everybody noticing, I'm laying my stuff aside. Somebody blow a trumpet. Here we go. I'm going to serve. No, he just did it. Just did it. This summer sabbatical time, one of the things we're trying to do for a fun kind of vacation-y aspect we did on our sabbatical is my son and I are trying to go to every Major League Baseball stadium by the time he graduates high school. I mentioned that before, and it's a great thing. So he's 9 years old, and we've been to 13 out of 30 baseball fields. So it's been great. So we're on a good pace to be able to do that. And I encourage you, dads, moms as well, whatever, do something like that. It doesn't have to be baseball stadiums. It doesn't have to be grandiose. It could be going fishing if that's what you're into and go to every lake in the city or in the state of Texas or whatever it is. It could be national parks that you go to. It could be, you know, ballets. You're going to see different plays. Whatever it is, you could do all sorts of things. You could figure out some cheap way if you need to be able to do that. So our thing is baseball, so we decided to do that. And just so you're worried, I didn't spend any church money on that, okay? That's my money. So on sabbatical, I went, and we went to Cincinnati, Cleveland, and Detroit. Some reason my wife did not want to go to Cincinnati, Cleveland, and Detroit. She's holding out for Los Angeles, Chicago, New York. But we went to Cincinnati, Cleveland, and Detroit. We flew to Cincinnati, rented a car, went to a Reds game, drove up to Cleveland, then drove up the next day to Detroit. People have been asking me. Cleveland was the best stadium out of the three, hands down. Tremendous fans. I mean, like, amazing fans. They sold out when they first opened the stadium, 455 home games in a row. They sold out. Now, we don't know what that's about, you know, in Houston, right? I mean, that's, we don't know. But they sold out in baseball, any of our sports, really. So, I mean, it's all the way through. So, 455 games. They were there 2 hours early. We got a ball from batting practice standing in the outfield. Great stuff. Amazing thing. So Cleveland was the best. Detroit was sad. And I don't mean that jokingly at all. It was sad. Downtown Detroit, you want to talk about something that feels like it got hit by the economy? Wow. That was a sad place. The stadium was great and all that sort of thing, but it's a sad place. Cincinnati, though, they had the Hall of Fame of the Reds in Cincinnati. Some of y'all remember the Big Red Machine. The Big Red Machine was in the 70s, and it was in the Cincinnati Reds. They were something. They were amazing. So they had this Hall of Fame in Cincinnati you could go through, and you'd walk in, and the only bad part is I thought when you bought a ticket, you got the Hall of Fame. You had to actually buy another ticket, so I was like, hey. So walk in, so you finally get in the Hall of Fame. They've got all this stuff, so it's Johnny Bench is everywhere because it was specializing in Johnny Bench for this year. Pete Rose, it's a Hall of Fame that Pete Rose is in everywhere. Dave Concepcion, Sparky Anderson, Joe Morgan, all these big Reds names. So we're going through and we're seeing all this stuff. It's great. We're having a great time before the game. And we get to this plaque that nobody's stopping at. Nobody's taking their picture by. Nobody's wondering what it's about. They're just kind of moving through. They glance and they keep on walking. This is the plaque. I'll show it to you. You can't really read it well, but I'll tell you about it. Matthias Schwab. They called him Matty. Matty Schwab. He was the groundskeeper for the Cincinnati Reds. He was the serve, if you will, of the Cincinnati Reds. Matthias Schwab was a groundkeeper. He was hired, get this, he was hired in 1894. Right before a game with the Cubs, they had moved into a new stadium. He got the grass down just in time. And Cub fans, sorry, the Reds won 5-0 in 1894 in that new grass that Matthias Matty Schwab had laid. Matty Schwab worked for the Cincinnati Reds. Hear this and let it blow your way. He was hired when he was 14 years old in 1894. He worked until 1963, he retired. 1894 to 1963, he worked all of those years and finally retired at 83 years old. Matty Schwab in the Hall of Fame. But let me tell you something. Matty Schwab never stood at the plate and they announced, Matty Schwab, up to bat, bases loaded, ninth inning, down by three. Didn't happen. They never said, now playing second base, Matty Schwab. They never had Matty Schwab up on the scoreboard. There wasn't a trading card, a baseball card of this park superintendent, of this yard man for the Cincinnati Reds. And yet he was in the Hall of Fame because hear it in connection with what we're talking about. Every day he got down on his hands and knees and he made sure that the grass that the Hall of Famers would play on would be perfect. So there'd be no bad hops, there'd just be good hits. Be a fair game between both teams. And from 1894 to 1963, he showed up with a rake and a hose and a lawnmower. That, my friend, is service. Forgetting himself, pulling himself out of it, not worried about himself, instead saying, I want the other nine people on the team and the other nine people from the other team. Let them play on the grass that I've been taking care of. That is what it means to be a servant. He didn't pretend like he was bad at yard work. He didn't pretend like he was a great hitter. He did what he was called to do. So if you're a great hitter, don't pick up a lawnmower and try to fake it. Pick up a bat and hit a home run. If you're a groundskeeper, pick up the lawnmower and the rake and let the body of Christ put it all together. Here's what happens, though, when that happens. You'll find that humility is blessedly uncomfortable. Humility is blessedly uncomfortable. Jesus washed their feet. It says in verse 5, as we begin to wrap up, after that he poured water into the basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. He washed their feet. And you know what? When we're humble and we serve, it's blessedly uncomfortable. Verse 17 that we'll get to next week, it says, and now that you know these things about the washing of feet, now that you know these things, you will be blessed, hear it, if you do them. Does it say you'll be blessed if you hear a sermon on it? Does it say you'll be blessed if you agree with me on it? Does it say you'll be blessed if you like that idea? It says you'll be blessed if you do it. Service has got to be more than an attitude. It's got to be an action. So I want to call you to a place of application. And then we'll wrap up. I want to ask you to apply this message, next week's message as well, and wash people's feet figuratively. That means it's symbolically you're volunteering, you're giving, you're a part of making a difference, you're forgetting yourself, and you're giving to somebody else and giving to the Lord. Forget yourself figuratively. That's serving in preschool, that's serving in the children's ministry, that's being a part of the downtown church we're going to plant. That's part of serving in wherever you serve, the United Way, wherever it is, outside the church, doesn't matter. Of giving yourself and saying, figuratively, I'm going to be a person that washes feet. Because I'm realizing my resources and my time and my talent, it's just a boomerang back to me. I need to forget myself in this deal. And then secondly, and this is where it's really going to be hard, I'm going to ask you that you would literally wash somebody's feet. Literally. Here's what I mean by that. This is in the upper room, and so my 2 cents worth on washing somebody's feet, the best context for that is in an intimate, tight-knit relationship. So This is not the feeding of the 5,000 with all these people on the mountainside that Jesus does this. This is his inner circle disciples, loving, tight-knit people, okay? So if Monday morning, tomorrow, you hear this message and you say, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to wash my boss's feet. And your boss shows up at the office and you're standing there with a towel around your waist and a thing of water, you're going to get fired is what's going to happen. And you should be. That's weird is what that is, okay? That's not Christian. That's weird. Don't show up at the office and be like, I'm just going to go and wash all the secretary's feet and be like, what are you doing? No. Guys, if you've been dating a girl and you've only gone out like a couple times, do not do this. Okay? Get her car and take it to Mr. Car Wash and wash her car, and she'll appreciate that. But don't, you know, bow down and start washing her feet. That's weird, okay? This is in a tight-knit, loving relationship. Husband, wife, maybe it's parent, child, child, parent. Somebody you love and you care for deeply. You bow down. You turn to John chapter 13. You say, I want to read this passage of scripture to you. And I want you to know I love you. And I want to serve you with everything I have. And symbolic of that, I just want to wash your feet as Jesus did. As you see, the tears start probably streaming down your wife's face. She's never heard you talk like that. Your heart's beating so fast, you don't know if it's going to stay in your chest, and you feel a little bit dumb, guys. You'll see an intimate blessing that will happen that crosses all cultural lines from the biblical Middle East to right here in the city of Houston. So I want to challenge you over the next couple weeks to be able to do that. Ladies, that gives you time for a pedicure if needed. Guys, you should not do those things. Real men do not do that, okay? Gives you a moment to get your heart ready and to say, I want to actively, literally serve. And what will happen then? The power of your life, you'll be ready to kick this thing off. You'll be just like Jesus. You won't be just with your backhand all the time trying to get something. You will be in that moment of control that you're able to throw it up, see your giftedness, and come right through the ball. And the advantage and the power and the blessing will be in your service. It might not be 155 miles an hour. It might be 55. It might be 5. But if you and I serve, it'll make a difference in all people's lives.
Thank you for listening to the teaching ministry of Houston's First Baptist Church. We invite you to worship with us anytime you're near. We're located at the corner of I-10 West and the 610 Loop. Visit us online at houstonsfirst.org.